From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. With the Me Too movement on sexual harassment in the workplace, it's become standard fare for reporters to cover misbehavior by top officials in government, business, media, entertainment, and elsewhere. And our guest today is a journalist who's written those stories, including about his own organization, National Public Radio. We're talking with NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. He's in New Hampshire as part of NHPR's Justice and Journalism series, our partnership with the Rudman Center at UNH Law. At our event last night, Folkenflik described what it was like to cover a Me Too story concerning his own employer, and he reflected more broadly on the vast changes in the American news landscape. Today in The Exchange, David Folkenflik is with us, and let's get you into our conversation. How have you seen the media industry change? What changes do you like? What don't you like? Let us know. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And David, welcome to New Hampshire and welcome to The Exchange.
Oh, I'm so glad to be back in studio here.
Well, so let's dive right into it, David. What was it like for you having to cover some pretty ugly stuff at your own organization, a place that you love, a place where you've worked for a long time?
Well, don't be shy, Laura. look, it's you approach this story from a human level. You approach the story as a colleague of the people you're writing about. You approach the story as a journalist trying to maintain appropriate distance so that you can see clearly what's newsworthy, what's not, what's pinned down, what's not. What do you need to share with the public? What reporting do you need to do to be able to get there? This was a painful story for NPR, no doubt. And obviously, for those women affected by misconduct, by people entrusted to help run the newsroom, particularly our the head of news, at least as reflected in allegations made against him and by a subsequent report by an outside law firm. They're the ones who had the most discomfort. They're the ones who were subject to the kinds of experiences that one would never envy. As a reporter, I don't want to compare my experiences to that. However, as a reporter, it was one of the tougher assignments I think I've ever faced in my career.
Really?
Because it, you knew this story would have effect on people's careers, people's lives. You knew this story would have effect on the climate in the news organization for which you work. You know, I believe in NPR's mission and values, and I am, you know, friendly or at times friendships with a lot of the people I work with, and that's human commerce, and that's important. But what was more important in this moment was the small cadre of us, myself, my editor, a senior editor involved with us, to think hard about pursuing this story as we would about any other institution, knowing that our audiences cared very much about accountability.
And knowing that colleagues of yours could lose their jobs.
And some did.
Yeah.
We didn't break the very first story on this. There were two allegations from women anonymously made by in the Washington Post about instances from the mid to late 1990s. But I was able to report on instances that were essentially contemporaneous, current. They were not of the Harvey Weinstein, Matt Lauer level. And at the same time, they affected very much the climate in the newsroom. And I heard that from women from the lower ranks to the top ranks of the news organization. And it was a serious thing to have to pursue.
Well, talking about, you know, Harvey Weinstein, Matt Lauer and so forth, and there have been allegations across industries, but especially, David, it seems to me, media and entertainment. Why do you think that's the case?
I think there are a couple reasons. I think that in many of the instances we're talking about, we are talking about, I mean, I feel as though there's a bit of a direct line. It's initially a dotted line that becomes a very direct line. It goes from Bill Cosby, about which we heard more news yesterday in court, to Roger Ailes, which really started to, I think, unwrap a lot of things at Fox News and a culture that had essentially been backwards engineered to not only tolerate but to enable extensive and rampant harassment of women at that network
by
the person.
And that's a story you've covered a lot, too,
issues
at Fox News around sexual harassment. Go ahead, David.
But at the very top of the thing, Ailes led to O'Reilly, O'Reilly 6 months later, and the New York Times is a pivotal player once you get to the O'Reilly element of it. They sort of became open for business. Then they go last fall to Harvey Weinstein, and things just erupt. And I do think that there is something about the celebrity of people like Cosby, people like Weinstein, where things were joked about in sort of a bleak, mordant way. About their behavior in semi-public settings, a one-liner in a cartoon somewhere or a riff in a comics a stand-up that sort of then leads to darker truths. And I think in media, you know, if you look at some of the names, Matt Lauer, if you look at Charlie Rose, if you look at some other figures, these are folks who are not the heads of major corporations, but they help to determine what's news and what's not. They help to determine who succeeds and who doesn't. They help to groom young people to become journalists. And that word grooming should be a good thing. You want to cultivate and mentor people. You want them to get on board. You want to spot talent. You want to encourage initiative. But you don't want to do it with the agenda of, you know, how can I get something out of this for myself in an insidious way?
Well, and so you're mentioning all these organizations that you covered, media organizations, Fox, and so forth. But at NPR, David, you know, and I'm quoting you here, a story you wrote, NPR's problems...
Check your sources on this stuff.
NPR's problems with sexual harassment are seen as especially disheartening because of the feminist legacy of its founding. The network was built in part of the foundation created by trailblazing female journalists such as Nina Totenberg, Linda Wertheimer, Cokie Roberts, Susan Stamberg, and you quote your colleague Rachel Martin as saying, you know, women have served as CEO, board chair, news chief, general counsel, as well as the heads of all major shows and reporting desks at NPR, Rachel says. And she basically says, that's what makes this so disheartening. So, and I remember when the stories about NPR came out, I too had that feeling that Rachel had, like, really? NPR? Come on. We're supposed to be better than that.
Supposed to be better than that. We aspire to an ideal that is not about celebrity and stardom. That is not the ultimate point of this, is glitz. It's to fill a mission. And I think that the network's journalists, by and large, do their very best to do that every single hour of every single day. You know, the one thing about NPR, it's fascinating. I came after working in newspapers in the for-profit sector. And there was a lot of concern when I arrived in 2004, 2005, were women, you know, successfully integrated sufficiently in things. And I thought, you know, there's room to grow. And these were hard-won victories. Even at NPR, there were certain kinds of sexism. Part a long conversation I once had with Susan Stamberg where she talked about how she joined NPR because the traditional networks wouldn't pay women, you know, what they would pay men. They wouldn't hire them. And NPR paid less, but they paid a going rate. For women, and that there was sort of a sexism built in the way the society had set things up, but that NPR was open for business. And if you think about our war correspondents, you know, we had and have the heads of the big shows, Morning Edition, All Things Considered, the Weekend Edition. If you think of our major desks, you know, these are all desks that are or have been headed by women, all the major roles. It is a different organization, and yet, our head of news, who joined in 2015, you know, clearly felt comfortable in speaking with younger female colleagues, using it as a kind of dating mechanism, a way in which he got something social out of it that was deeply confusing and troubling to them. And there was two instances, as we later learned, but there was one instance I learned of some time ago in which a young woman went out to dinner with him and felt very much having a three-hour conversation of which only about 30 or 40 minutes she felt was appropriate. Mm. It wasn't explicitly sexual. He never touched her in a way that she felt was wrong, although there was an awkward hug apparently. But, you know, this was something that affected how she felt about it, and it affected the waters. It tainted things for her. It tainted things for her friends and colleagues she told about, and it became a thing in the newsroom. And it turned out it wasn't isolated. So that was an issue too. But let me say one other thing about the media. You ask about the media, why is it that this is what this Me Too moment has been so much about?
Yeah, I think media, part of entertainment, and so forth.
Part of it is that these younger women, or at least women generally younger to the men involved, have been often overlooked or sort of dismissed by the men who preyed upon them or attempted to target them. And sort of forgotten by them, but very smart people. They know how the media works. They know how to use an interview. They know how to use a microphone when they want to. They know how to present documentary evidence, and they know people in the media. So this isn't the case of the keys falling on the other side of the street, but you look on the lamppost, under the lamppost, because that's where the light goes. There were keys there. But I think that something, there is something about the proximity to the journalists, the knowledge that we have of the circumstances, the realization that something that some journalists knew about but thought, well, geez, that's part of the landscape. Don't go near that guy after six, was actually newsworthy. I think that the accretion of Cosby and Ailes and O'Reilly and Weinstein, and suddenly people had had enough.
Well, that's a good point because, you know, to my question about why media and entertainment so much, partly it's not that this doesn't happen in other types of industries. It's that the mostly young women involved knew enough and were savvy enough to get those stories out there. Whereas, you know, we've heard now with this whole Me Too movement from, you know, waitresses and female truck drivers who are just, you know, just trying to crank out their jobs every day, and they don't have access to that type of information getting.
That, well, yeah. I mean, I've gotten because I've done these stories, I've gotten tips from listeners and correspondents, I guess, who've called me about things in architecture, music, accounting, law. You know, I mean, you could almost just go through the A's and start there, and it would all be
and then
true.
Go to the B's.
It would all be true. Now, not all of these men are as prominent. And so, you know, if you say Charlie Rose, tens of millions of Americans know who that is, so that's going to be a headline.
Gotcha.
If you say Charlie Diphthong, who's an architect somewhere else who's prominent in Cincinnati, people may not know that, and it may not be as much of a story outside of that local area.
Well, our guest this hour in The Exchange is David Folkenflik. If that's a familiar name, he's NPR's media correspondent. He's in New Hampshire as part of our Justice and Journalism series. It's a partnership with the Rudman Center at UNH Law. Folkenflik joined us for a live public event last night. He's in our studio this morning talking about some of the same themes that came up at our event. What we mean by media today and some of the huge shifts that we've seen in the American news landscape. We'd love to hear from you. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. What changes have you noticed in the news and media industries? What changes do you think are for the better? What changes do you think are not for the better? Again, you can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And David, here's an email that came in from Allison in Manchester, who was at the event last night. She says, David was asked last night what he believed to be the greatest threat to journalism today. And he replied that he believed it to be the reduction of journalistic resources at the local level. Allison says, I'd like to follow up on that question and ask him to discuss the rise of the citizen or amateur journalists who seem to be jumping into this void. How do we address this? Given that many of us live in media echo chambers, how do we avoid falling into the trap of amplifying what is so often truly fake news? Allison says, I am reminded of the recent study that showed that fake news stories are 70% more likely to be retweeted than real news. Allison, thank you so much. And David, what do you think?
Well, let's not forget, it's a lot easier to write a headline that people want to click or share if it's not true. You aren't encumbered by facts or nuance. So you can write something that said, you cannot believe what Senator so-and-so did when nobody was looking. And people say, oh, my God, Senator so-and-so, let me click. And that's not actually particularly good because that's not necessarily true. I think, you know, I guess I'm cursed by seeing texture and nuance in a lot of circumstances. It seems to me that the rise of social media has eroded the barriers that people had to publishing or broadcasting information. And so you can have what, forgive me, was it?
Allison.
Allison. Thanks for coming last night, Allison. It was a great event, but at the Rudman Center at the University of New Hampshire School of Law. But the drop in the barrier to broadcast or publication, the ability of people just to upload things on Twitter, Facebook, or Periscope, or on WordPress, or Medium, or whatever, means that on the one hand, you have all kinds of people spreading inadvertently uninformed or half-truths or suppositions or rants or whatever. You also have a bunch of actually bad actors, people who are trying to create a chum in the water, people who are trying to make it the information flow murky, whether it be people operating on behalf of the Russians, partisan activists, people doing it for profit, people doing it for sort of a spiteful fun. And you see all kinds of such actors taking place right now. On the other hand, we have access to real-time information from people that you might otherwise see a sentence from in a Wall Street Journal story, and they can post about events in real time, and they may be economists, they may be astronauts, they may be engineers, they may be former lawmakers, they may be experts in these areas and able to provide really interesting insight, and then provide it off, oftentimes, firsthand sources. That is original source documentation, or provided off analysis of interviews or of legislation, and it's an incredible service. The question is getting to the good stuff
and
figuring that stuff
out.
But I do think that we're at a moment where there is at once a more chaotic flow of information, and yet there's the ability for people with expertise to weigh in uninvited. Rather than sitting and waiting for somebody to call at Penn State University or something, they can pop in, and suddenly journalists following on social media, as so many of us do, can pluck those things out, can find common threads, can find illuminating insights that they never would have come across before. And so there's it's not simply that you're looking for that expert and, oh, my God, am I going to find that former head of the Council of Economic Advisors? It's that somebody else may do that for you and either share it or build on it. And so there is at once an erosion and a strengthening of the information flow at the same time.
That's a more positive description than a lot of people give. A lot of people would probably give that description that you described, chum in the water. We forget, David, that 20 years ago, you know, there were gatekeepers like you and me saying this deserves to get on the air because we've checked it out, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. This doesn't because we haven't checked it out and we think it's a little bit, you know, sketchy. Now it's just sort of boom, anything goes. Anything's out there, true, not true, whatever. So it's interesting to me that you have a more positive take on it than a lot of folks.
I mean, I can slice it the other way, too.
Yeah.
I can talk about all the real problems with it, but I think we have to acknowledge that. We also have to acknowledge that gatekeepers a generation ago, while most of them probably well-intentioned, may not have said, you know, I'm going to reach into smaller communities and find those voices. I'm going to be able to find women of color. I'm going to be able to find younger people out of college. We can find sources representing a greater array of the people who make up the American mosaic than we did before as a result of this. That's important, and in ways that can strengthen our journalism, too. You know, public radio is actually often pretty good at doing that. And shows like this, where people get to call in or to volunteer their thoughts again, I think stirs up and stimulates communities to do that. But I do think that while I can be very bleak about certain trends in journalism and talk about resources and talk about the dystopia that you often find online or that often flows toward you, even if you do almost nothing, there are also ways in which there are benefits that I think get overlooked.
So overall, social media, has it benefited traditional media or not?
I think that, you know, you can sit like King Canute along the shoreline, hold your hand up and demand that the waves stop and the tides recede, and it just won't happen. You know, technology is enabling this. If you look in newspapers, at the turn of the previous century, about what the effects of radio would be, you would see a lot of people talking about the corrosion of American society.
Really?
And how this is, oh, sure. You know, each new technology frightens the one that occurred before. And I don't think that it's wrong to be very concerned, as hearings this week will prove in Washington, about what social media brings. But I think this is where we're going, and we're going to have to find ways to make it work.
A lot more questions for David Folkenflik. Allison, thank you so much for that one. You can send us an email as well, exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment.
I listen to NHPR a lot.
Which is why Scott Brown of Franklin is a sustaining member of NHPR's leadership circle.
Trust, dedication, integrity, those are values that I see from top to bottom in NHPR, and we're just proud to be a part of the family.
You too can become a part of NHPR's leadership circle when you invest $100 a month into the statewide news service you trust. Join the family at nhpr.org/leadership circle.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoi. Today, the evolution of American media. We're talking with NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. He's in New Hampshire as part of our Justice and Journalism series, a partnership with the Rudman Center at UNH Law. Folkenflik joined us for a public event last night. He's in our studio this morning. We're talking about the many, many changes in the American news and media landscape. And we'd love to hear from you. What changes have you noticed in terms of news and media? What changes are for the better? What changes do you think are not for the better? Send us your questions. Email exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And David, just before the break, we were responding to an email from Allison, who asked, you know, some great questions about the evolution of media, fake news. You talked a lot about social media. I asked you just before the break, is social media good or bad for traditional media? And you said, you know, you can't hold it back. People said some of the same things about radio. And maybe we can't even talk about, you know, new media, old media anymore, given how much traditional media like NPR participates in social media. I mean, it's almost a false distinction now, isn't it?
There are ways in which it is a false distinction. You know, news is conveyed and transmitted on a variety of platforms, much of it social media, and we've got to play there. On the other hand, are they partners? Are they frenemies? Are they simply platforms that you're agnostic about? Like,
no, when you say they, who do you mean?
If you're thinking from the perspective of media outfits and you're looking at social media platforms, you know, for a couple of years there, Facebook paid a lot of news organizations, including, I want to be clear, NPR, to produce Facebook Live videos. Content that to some extent goes on today. I think NPR made a low seven figures off that over a couple of years. And it helped subsidize acquisition of equipment for us to do things that was not to do with Facebook. And it helped in some ways give people some training in doing streaming video and the like. We were in a kind of partnership with them. And that's true that we did it even as we were covering them. But we do all kinds of partnerships and we do all kinds of deals. And that as long as it's disclosed, that's okay. But Facebook essentially was saying, we want you to be doing your business on us, and Facebook would essentially control the data, and Facebook would essentially control the flow, and Facebook could decide whether to boost up how many people saw what you do or take it away. And a lot of news organizations, including BuzzFeed and Upworthy and others, sort of new media organizations, found that at times their fortunes would rise and fall on the whims of somebody tweaking the algorithm out there in Menlo Park. So this was a realization that even if there was some subsidy going on, or often when not, but traffic was being boosted, that you were relying on somebody else's decisions that would be out of your hand. And I think that is ultimately pretty disturbing.
Did NPR ultimately end that financial relationship?
It did. I don't think it broke with acrimony. I think they thought it played out. I don't know that Facebook wanted to continue that. Facebook is often trying to find ways to, in some ways, bolster and increase the presence of credible news organizations as a way of improving its credibility with people as a way to get information. It's anxious about that, even as it seemingly doesn't care. It wants the New York Times and NPR and other major news organizations to be big players on their site because their stuff often proves highly positive, and it also confers an aura of credibility on them as a platform. But, you know, they hold the cards in the sense that they are overwhelmingly profitable. They know what they're doing, even as they don't seem to know what they're doing in all the scandals that are playing out right now. It is... If you're at, you know, our caller asked the question, is social media good in a sense? And the problem is for news organizations, it's been nightmarish. It has wrested control out of newsrooms for their destiny. And people's eyeballs are much more likely to be diverted to other material not related to you if they're looking at your stories on Facebook. They might read that story, but it's going to be harder to keep them on board, whereas if they're opening the pages of the Concord Monitor, they're going to be turning the page to the next page of the Concord Monitor. Or if they're clicking on the website, it's more likely to be done that way.
But nightmarish.
Sure.
That's big word.
Just look where the advertising dollars are going. Digital advertisers are much less likely to advertise in the Boston Globe than they are on, if they could do it with Google and Facebook and places people turn. You know, those are the two dominant digital advertising players right now, and they know how to do it, and they're thinking ahead of how to keep on doing it. It has been a challenge for news organizations to convert would have been print dollars. You know, we thought it would be into digital dimes. In some instances, it's digital pennies.
Yeah, because, and this is more talking about private media, not so much public radio, but
right.
private media that used to rely and quite successfully on classified advertising and so
right.
forth.
I mean, the subscriptions that people used to pay for newspapers was a nice 20, 25, 30% of the revenue
right.
that newspapers counted on. The real, you know, this is true for Facebook and it was true for old newspapers, which is that as reader, you thought you were the customer. You were the product. You were being handed over to the advertiser who is the true client. But the nice thing about that model in the old days was it actually paid for a lot of good journalism. And now news organizations that are newspapers are turning to readers to become subscribers in the way in which, to some degree, we at Public Radio ask our listeners to become members.
Right. And that's sort of a new idea for a lot of folks. Like, oh, this newspaper used to be so cheap. Why is it so expensive online? And it's because the advertising isn't there the way it used to be. I definitely want to talk to you about newsroom resources, the shrinking of local coverage that you see, David, but also fold our listeners into our conversation. So you can join us. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Give us a call. We're having a broad conversation with NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik about some of the huge, huge changes he's seen in his many years of covering news and media. Again, you can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And David, Kevin's in Manchester. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Well, good morning, and thank you for having me,
sure.
Laura and David. A wonderful, wonderful show. I think it brings this topic to the dining room table. It's, you know, I haven't had the pleasure of meeting you two, but I've listened to you for years. And I know you're willing to ask the tough question. If someone in your panel is leaning right, you ask left. If it's left, it's right. So I trust you. For some of the other NPR people, I don't. And this fake news on Facebook does bother me. Anyone who didn't know they were selling your information was naive. So how do you find out if, for example, I've seen several posts that congressmen and representatives in the Senate have spent thousands or millions of our tax dollars paying off harassment charges? How do you discern? I can't find it anywhere else if that is true or fake news?
Oh, yeah.
And I ask you guys because
sure.
I know you'll come back and say, no, that's fake news, and I can trust that. So,
well, Kevin, it's a great
show.
Question. Yeah. Thank you for the
Keep
kudos,
the
too,
one.
By the way. You know, it's a great question, and this gets kind of to what Allison emailed before is, you know, people say, you know, journalists and they like to criticize us, but real journalists do the work to figure out what's fake and what isn't. And it's a lot of work and it takes time. And sometimes it's just easier to put out rumors on social media.
Sure. Well, look, I think that what's being asked of us as readers and viewers and listeners is a more aerobic form of news consumption than what our parents and grandparents were being asked to do. We're being asked not only to think through and evaluate the news that we're being presented, but we're being asked to evaluate those who are doing the presenting and the credibility of the sources, not just of the journalists, but of the sources of information we're relying on, the outlets themselves. And we are thinking more consciously about this than I think we ever have as a country. Can I trust where I'm getting the information from? In the instance that Kevin referred to, and I appreciate his listening and his support of NHPR, yes, there's a congressman who resigned just a few days ago. I may mispronounce his name, but I believe his name is Blake Ferentold. He's a Republican congressman from Texas. I believe he paid off in excess of $80,000 in taxpayer money to settle harassment claim by one of his own senior aides. And he had been accused of various kinds of misconduct before, but this is a pretty stark version. He had said he might not run for re-election. He's resigned. And that is real news. One of the ways in which you can evaluate sources of information is whether or not their stories hold up over time. You've seen the president, and obviously in some ways he's lurking as a figure anytime we talk about the phrase fake news, which is not, I think, the same as saying reporting that's wrong or mistaken. I think fake news is fabricated. It's not news at all. But in a report like this, you look to whether or not a source of information has been consistently borne out over time. And for example, the Post and the Times, even when contradicted by the president, have by and large proven to be very much right, much more often than he has in such circumstances. And secondly, you look at the transparency of the reporting itself. Are the sources named? Are there documents? If there are documents, are they linked to? Can you read them? You know, there are all kinds. Do they quote from them directly? There are all kinds of ways in which there are cues that you can use to evaluate the solidity of it, even as at times people seeking to deceive or mislead may mimic those.
So, Kevin, as a savvy news consumer, you're kind of saying read things a little more carefully. To answer his question, you
which
know,
is not a rebuke, by the way.
Yeah,
but I would say if somebody on a blog says Congressman resigns, blah blah blah, follow the links.
Yeah,
see where the links go. Do they go to Gateway Pundit, which is conservative, and that's fine, but is also traffics in conspiracy theories that are not grounded in fact, and that's not fine. You know,
interesting.
And I think that, you know, you look to see where the links go. And if the links go back to Politico or The Washington Post or The Wall Street Journal or ABC News and they have documents or they have a clip of the guy on the record saying I'm resigning now or that's all I'm going to say about that. But it's clear that it's in response to that question. At least you can see that there's some meat to the bone there.
Well, and Kevin, I hope that answers your question. And just listening to you talk, David, it seems like that's how listeners like Kevin can discern what's real and what isn't. It does take a lot more work. You know, we used to just turn on Walter Cronkite and he would tell us and we would say, okay,
yeah,
done. I can go make dinner now.
Yeah, you know? Right. And Cronkite was really good at what he did. And that was a less rounded view of America than we now have. But
Fair
it's
point.
Also a more fragmented view of it because we're getting it in shards. And we're also consuming because it's not 25 million people sitting to the same newscast and 70 million people looking at the big three. It's maybe 25 million people looking at the three big newscasts. We don't have a shared understanding of what the news is. I saw a tweet from a friend of mine this morning saying, you know, alternate realities and showing all these reports on cable news about the raid on the president's lawyer's office. Michael Cohen, the special prosecutor, had ordered it. It was approved by a U.S. attorney, I guess, in New York. There was a picture on Fox saying House committee seeking records on a Clinton email issue. And, you know, those were just two different realities of what was being presented and what was relevant.
Well, and those who lament sort of this fragmented media landscape will often reference, you know, Walter Cronkite, everybody watching. But you're right, David. That was a view of the world, too. And it was largely sort of a white, you know, capitalist, middle class. I mean, there are other points of view out there that were not reflected in that sort of allegedly rosier time.
There was this amazing anecdote. I've read a lot about Walter Cronkite over the years, and I believe I interviewed him once. He did some commentaries for NPR later in life and, you know, was genuinely an important figure in American news and did important work. But I saw this incredible interview with a guy who had been a protester. He had been a gay rights activist, and at one time he broke into the CBS Evening News newsroom during a live broadcast and disrupted it.
Jeepers.
And if I'm not mistaken, forgive me if I'm getting one of the details wrong or here or there, but he was prosecuted for trespass and there was an issue here. And Cronkite saw him in court and said, why'd you do this? And he said, you keep referring to gays as though they're deviant and we're just trying to live our lives and understand each other, but you never reflect that on the news. You never show that. And Cronkite, to his astonishing credit, talked to his executive producer, and they produced a series of reports exploring gay rights issues at a time where the nightly news, the evening newscast, had been closed off to them. And it took a guy basically, you know, essentially setting off a flare gun, you know, during a studio shot in the live evening news to accomplish that. And that shows you a little bit about how sealed that world was.
That's a good way to put it. Sealed. Lots of emails from our listeners. So let's
Please.
Go to them, David. And again, you can email us, exchange@nhpr.org. We're having a broad conversation about the current state of our news and our media, and we'd love your thoughts, reflections, criticisms, praise, whatever you want. Email exchange@nhpr.org or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You can also respond on Facebook or Twitter. It's NHPR Exchange. Again, the email exchange@nhpr.org. And got a bunch of emails here, David, that I want to share with you. Picking up on our conversation about fake news, and we got a lot of questions about this last night, Martha wrote us a poem about fake news, and I would love to share this with you. Wow, Martha. Over my career, I've tried to get people to sing on the air and have been successful, but I think this is the first time somebody's composed a
public
poem.
Public radio at its best.
I love it. So here we go from Martha. Fake news gives me the blues. You can believe whatever you choose. Alternative fact. What the heck is that? It's very uncouth not to tell the truth. Misleading words, how absurd. If I string along, I'll get it all wrong. We'd be wise to examine the lies and not let our zeal believe what's not real. Fake news gives me the blues. If I repeat it, we all lose.
That's awesome.
Bravo, Martha. Thank you for the email. Here's another one that comes in. This is from Kim. I'm so disappointed in NPR and CNN and the news media, which seem to be chasing Fox's tail, Kim says. Many people I know have stopped watching and listening to the news because most of the media, including NPR's, time and content consists of superficial and repetitive reporting of the U.S. political scandal du jour and speculation among other media members about what it means and what might happen next, instead of in-depth reporting, true analysis of current affairs. Kim says she now turns to the BBC, which provides me with actual news, covers the world, and by the way, does not have the advertising interruptions that NPR's extended sponsorship announcements have turned into. Now, we got some of this last night at our event, too, David. You know, does the media just cover the inside the beltway, scandal du jour, instead of the real stuff, the real deal? Thank you, Kim, for the email, by the way.
All right. That's an extensive bill of particulars there. The first thing I'd say is just up front, you know, my paycheck comes from NPR and I'm proud of NPR, but I do not reflect management. And they allow me, to their credit, but it's contractual, the leeway to say what I want about them. So what I'm about to say is not sanctioned by them per se. I think if you listen to NPR thoroughly, there is a ton of extension coverage, enterprise work, analysis, and insight provided, context beyond the immediate text, if you will, that the organization should feel proud of. And I think it's a lot to ask of listeners to go and listen to all of it. So it may strike the ear, and the things at the top of the hour may reflect the 45-second bites of what's happening. But I think if you want to hear about immigration, you've heard stories from all over the country and from Central America about some of the issues affecting here. If you want to hear about Syria, we have veteran, seasoned crisis reporters, Jane Araf, Deb Amos, and others who have done extraordinary work actually going into Syria at times and reporting on this stuff. If you want to talk about healthcare and the issues affecting the country, you know, we've summoned voices from all over and all points of view, and yet also sought to provide fixed understandings of where certain truths lie and emerge. And I think that you could go on issue after issue of that. I also want to say it's one thing, you know, I think here in New Hampshire, Brendan Nyhan, who's a very distinguished political science professor at Dartmouth, who I like a lot, he's done work about how scandal rhythms go and how in times of less crisis or less intense news cycles, lesser scandals bubble up and are treated as though they're full-blown scandals. And at other times, and there's even a little element of this where there's question about the coverage of Chappaquiddick. It happened at the same weekend as the moon landing. Chappaquiddick didn't get the same coverage. But one of the interesting things about this is that I think right now we're at a moment with the Trump administration where these seemingly mini scandals are actually genuinely scandalous. And there's concern that this may prove to be one of the most ethically challenged, one of the most corrupt administrations perhaps in almost a century. I think these scandals do deserve coverage, and I think they are important because they reflect on the people who pilot our country right now.
Well, Kim, I really appreciate the email. Thank you for jumping in. And a couple more emails after a short break, and we'll take your calls as well, 1-800-892-6477.
NHPR's Leadership Circle is a community of listeners who place a high value on intelligent and independent radio. I'm Sarah Alger, Director of Major Gifts at NHPR. As a Leadership Circle sustaining member, your $100 a month investment helps NHPR create and deliver the award-winning news you trust and the outstanding programs you love. If you've been looking to deepen your commitment to the station that's an essential part of your life and your community, join us at nhpr.org/leadershipcircle.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, we keep an eye on the big upcoming votes at the State House. We sit down with a panel of Republican and Democratic lawmakers. What bills are you watching at this point in the legislative season? Send us your comments by email, exchange@nhpr.org. exchange at nhpr.org before the show, and then join us tomorrow. Now, this hour, we're talking about the national media with David Folkenflik, NPR's media correspondent. He's in New Hampshire as part of our Justice and Journalism series, a partnership with the Rudman Center at UNH Law. Send an email for David, your comments, questions about some of the changes you have seen in the news and media industries, some of the undercovered stories that you'd like to see covered more, as our last emailer suggested. Again, our email address is exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And David, here's another one that just came in. This is from Janet, who says, I have thought about this a lot. I don't think there's ever been a time when good journalism from places like NPR, New York Times, Washington Post is as important as now. Would there even be an investigation into election interference without the reporting that brought it to light? I have been horrified at the Trump administration's treatment of the media and the effort to make the fake news real and the real news fake. Janet says, my 33-year-old daughter does not trust any news outlet. She is getting her news online, which worries me. The good thing is the serious, intrepid reporters who are still doing their jobs with integrity despite the media-hating Trump administration. This is really interesting. Janet, thank you so much. She loves, you know, NPR, Washington Post, and so forth, but her daughter does not trust any news outlet. So how does the media deal with that, David?
Well, the question I'd have for mom in this circumstance is whether her 33-year-old daughter is consuming news online that originated in the Washington Post and the New York Times and NPR and other places.
And if it's just being recycled.
If you go to Yahoo News or Google News or a lot of stuff that's shared on Facebook and on Twitter and other places, a lot of those things that are from actual news organizations started somewhere quite credible. Oftentimes, they are picked up by other places that do hyper-aggregations and do a tiny bit of topspin like The Hill or, you know, any number of other places. And suddenly you're linking to a watered-down version of it. And the question is, are people going to take the time to link to the original reporting or to an authoritative version of the reporting? And the answer is not always. And the answer is not usually. So there's that concern. And certainly if you're getting it from the equivalent of comfort food websites, they're going to have their own take on it, minimizing the bad light that it might cast people that you might think well of, or maximizing the harshness and severity of the tone and the take of somebody that you might think badly of.
What's a comfort food website? I've never heard that phrase before.
I'm making it up, but you know, it's the equivalent of what MSNBC is for a lot of liberals or a lot of folks who take great exception to the Trump administration. There's some good journalists through there. I think there are actually some very smart analysts, some of them, interestingly, not from the left. You think of Nicole Wallace's new show in the afternoon there. I think she's very good, but she's clearly a never-Trumper. And so that's comfort food for people who are Republicans who can't abide Trump. And it's also comfort food, I think, for liberals who are happy to see a Republican take shots at this Republican White House.
So they can feel good about themselves. I'm listening to an alternative view, but it's not that alternative.
Yeah. I mean, again, I think there's some smart stuff done on that show. But an example would be that I've heard from certain, you know, viewers. You talk about people who may look at places that provide an ideological point of view, even as it's folded into some real reporting or analysis. And that's comfort food's not necessarily bad food. It's not necessarily bad for you, but it shouldn't be the only thing that you're having.
Well, picking up on something you said, that the you advised Janet to look at the sources of those online articles that her daughter's reading, and maybe if they're from the Washington Post, then fine. But you also talked last night, David, about the decimation of some, especially local news departments, really kind of critiquing the corporate owners of these newspapers, mostly, although there's TV and radio too, gutting local news departments. And then I turned around and said, okay, fair enough, but what about the readers and the listeners and the viewers? If they were really, really invested in that local news product, it would be very profitable and everybody would be happy and the corporate owners would be very happy to dump all sorts of money into the newsroom. So I'd love for you to just riff on that for a little bit with us. The decline in local news, corporate owners cutting resources to local news. But why not? If nobody's watching or reading, why shouldn't they?
Well, there are times where I feel like critiquing these owners of local news shops the way I might critique Stalin for starving millions of people, you know, during the famines there in Russia. Some of the choices that have been made by owners of local and smaller newsrooms around the country are not defensible except in terms of a profit. And I used to work for for-profit newspaper companies, and I'm fine with that. I had a great time working there, and I have no regrets about that. But there was a point at which news organizations were owned by companies that decided they wanted to make 15, 20, 25, 35% profit margins.
I see. So it's about the margins. It's fine to make a profit running a media organization.
It gets worse. Believe me, it gets worse. And that worked for a while in the 80s. And starting in the 90s, that wasn't attainable with the same level of funding. So you saw a lot of news organizations start to cut back and pare back. And we thought that was significant. And it wasn't anything like significant because the internet really didn't become a common household thing until 96 on. And suddenly that changed people's viewing habits. So we can decide as readers to subscribe to papers, and I think people should subscribe to papers they value as a way of supporting it, much like I think people should be giving money to NHPR if they listen and rely on it. You know, these things take money to operate, and it helps sustain us at NPR, the fact that people do what they do for you guys. But that's not the only thing going on. People say, oh, well, there was the recession of 2008, 2009, and that was real. People say there are technological changes, and that was absolutely real. But there was also the desire to maintain profits at the cost of maintaining mission. And there's not really a point for a newspaper to be in business if it can't maintain an accountability mission in a city. We no longer have very many cities at all in which there's more than one major news outlet.
It's hard to believe that there used to be maybe two or three in some big cities and maybe two in a small city.
That's right. That's right. And that's not the case anymore. We saw recently the Denver Post publish a special section of commentary last Sunday in which their editorial page editor trashed his own owners, a hedge fund, I believe it's the Alden Capital Group, for gutting and gutting and gutting and gutting. It's almost as though organs are being harvested from people while they're still alive. And it's astonishing, the cutbacks. We've done a lot of coverage of a company named Tronc, which is really the old Tribune newspaper company, owner of the Los Angeles Times, although they're in the process of selling that, owner of the Chicago Tribune, my old paper, the Baltimore Sun, the Hartford Courant, and some other really distinguished metro papers. And they've cut back and cut back and cut back to the point where news organizations no longer cover regions. They cover states. They no longer cover states. They cover metro areas. And sometimes they don't cover the metro areas very well themselves. And they are still capable of doing some great work, but they can't cast the broad nets they once did. These are places of deeply constricted ambition. And the problem is, if we stop having newsrooms that cast light on what people at city halls and county councils and tax assessors and state governments are doing, we are not going to understand what the people we entrust with our votes are doing in our name and with our dollars. And that can be a very dark time. And so we're a bit on the precipice on this stuff. And so when you have major news organizations, the Los Angeles Times unionized in part because they no longer trusted their ownership to treat them fairly as employees, but also to put the mission as a primary element of what they do. A mission-driven organization that wants a significant profit is always going to have that tension. But a lot of these companies, they're not talking a lot about that tension. They're just not focusing on the mission in the way that which they once did. And the journalists who are achieving some terrific journalism that those corporate owners point to are often doing so despite rather than because of the nature of the ownership.
So is it possible to have corporate ownership of a news organization, especially some of these, smaller metro papers, and continue that mission? Is it all about a choice? Is it possible to still make a profit and run a business in news today, given, again, the swirling news consumption habits of Americans?
I think so. I mean, there's some changes. There's no silver bullet on this stuff. You've got to train people to recognize what they value and to pay money for it, probably less than they would pay daily at Starbucks or even Dunkin' Donuts, but contribute something toward it. I think that you're going to have to make sure there's something of value every day for people to turn to. Part of the problem is not, hey, people aren't valuing it. It's that so much has been removed from these news organizations that they can now get instantaneously from anywhere in the world that, why would you go to a newspaper that's been gutted? Why would you go to a place that has a quarter or a third or a fifth of the resources it once had to cover the local communities and say, this is really thin and what is there is padded.
Yeah, so it's a chicken and egg question, isn't it, David?
Yeah.
Is it worth making the investment if we perceive that people aren't reading or watching? And so they yank the investment and then it becomes thinner and shallower. And so, you know what I mean? It's kind of a downward spiral.
There are a lot of hopes being pinned in newsrooms on benevolent billionaires and markets across the country picking up. And sometimes that works well and sometimes that does not. But you have seen, you know, I think the Boston Globe has had some really hard times. But I do think John Henry genuinely wants it to be a civic institution that's meaningful as well as being in the black. You see in Minneapolis, a new owner there trying to ensure that the Star Tribune is a viable watchdog reporter. He has a lot of wealth. You see Jeff Bezos, you know, fished out coins from his couch and bought the Washington Post as a personal property. And he's done two things. He gave it stability, he gave it time, and he's also given it a path to profitability, where they've instituted new practices, new customer service, new ways of measuring what they do, and it seems to be in the black after a time in which it looked like it was going to be declining very quickly.
Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Or again, send us an email like a lot of folks have. It's exchange@nhpr.org. One more question for you, David, please, on this idea of profit, news, whether you can make a profit doing news, how much you focus on the mission of news and how much you focus on the profit. Tell us really quickly, please, about the story you did recently on Sinclair Broadcasting. First of all, just because it's all wrapped up and it's kind of emblematic of everything we talked about this hour. Profitability, the news mission, social media, politicization of our sort of news consuming society. Just remind us, first of all, we'll break it down. What is Sinclair? How big is it? How important is it?
So Sinclair is based in Hunt Valley, Maryland, outside Baltimore. It is an essentially unknown company that is owns more television stations than any other in this country and is poised to buy a whole bunch more.
Before I started preparing for this interview, I did not know that.
And that's why you tune into public radio every day, Laura.
Go ahead.
So they own 190 stations. They're about to acquire 30-plus more from Tribune Media, take over what's left of that television empire. And they swept. They got essentially the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission to sweep away a lot of restrictions that would have made it a lot tougher for them to do so. This was an FCC chairman who was elevated by President Trump last year and who has had very close ties to Sinclair. And the president in recent days has been tweeting enthusiastically and frequently in favor of Sinclair, which is a place that has given him fairly sympathetic coverage. Why has he done that? Well, they've come under criticism for this statement that was sent around to essentially all of their news organizations that local news anchors had to read, talking about their fears about other media, talking about their fears about fake stories getting circulated, and essentially doing a little bit of negative campaigning about the rest of the media. I don't think anybody would have cared about this, but for two things. One, it was essentially a corporate message being presented as though it were a personal observation, and they were trading upon the connection these local anchors had built over the years in each of these markets to convey a corporate message in the guise of a personal epiphany.
Sure, because the viewers in those local markets, Cincinnati or, you know, wherever, trust those anchors. They see them every night.
That's right. You're turning in because of the connection they forged, and those stations work hard to make you feel that connection, mm-hmm. to personalize the news for you. So I think that that was a disturbing element of it. And the second thing is that because the rhetoric, although it was fine if it had been done by a corporate executive, whatever, because the rhetoric so clearly echoes what the president says about the news media, even if it's less harsh, even if it wasn't specific about who it was criticizing, it's hard not to look at that in light of a news organization that has hired a former Trump aide as its chief political analyst on the air, has done fairly favorable stuff in other coverage, built up a warm rapport during the election season. They say they offered the same kind of access to Hillary Clinton's officials to be on their shows and that they just didn't take it up as often. But nonetheless, Sinclair is clearly a safe space for Trump fans at a time where they're asking for favors to be done by the Trump administration in their pursuit of these other stations.
Well, just to put a final note on this, let's play a little bit from Scott Livingston. He's the head of Sinclair. And this is him reading the statement that he then had his local anchors around the country read, denouncing so-called fake news.
The sharing of bias and false news has become all too common on social media. More alarming, national media outlets are publishing these fake news stories without fact-checking. Unfortunately, some members of the national media are using their platforms to push their own personal bias and agenda to control exactly what people think. This is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
Well, and that's Scott Livingston again of Sinclair Broadcasting. Just to give people a sense of what you're talking about there, David, lots of emails have come in the past few minutes. I'd love to share a couple of these with you before we close out.
Go for it.
Gary, I'm going to cut this a little bit short, and I apologize. He says, I feel the mainstream media, and this includes NPR, NHPR, and The Exchange, live in fear of conservative media. As an example, the recent interview by Fox News of Scott Pruitt. If someone from mainstream media had been as aggressive with Mr. Pruitt as that reporter, they would be labeled as bullies, yet that reporter is only practicing good journalism with his follow-up questions. Gary says, I often feel the mainstream media lack credibility with the dearth of follow-up questions in journalism today. Too often, journalists ask a question, get an answer, and leave it as that. And Gary says, this is a legacy of the backlash from conservative media. Please comment on this effect. Gary's a great point. I wish we had more time, but go ahead, David.
Well, gosh, I think if you listen to almost any interview with Steve Inskeep or Michelle Martin or a number of our other hosts do with figures in public office or public life, you'd see some very agile and muscular intellects at work and pressing people accountable. The other thing I'd say about the Ed Henry interview, it at once was good journalism. He was pressing him hard and skeptically. But at the same time, this was not in opposition to the entire Trump administration. You have forces within the Trump administration that want Scott Pruitt gone. And I think that this was reflective in some ways of a school of thought residing in the chief of staff's office, John Kelly. So there's interesting forces at work, even as I do admire the way in which the questioning occurred. It was not as though it was done in opposition to the administration. It was done in a tough scrutiny of that official.
Interesting. Okay, well, Gary, thank you very much. And I wish we had more time to kind of pull that one apart a little bit more. But Tom in Portsmouth wants to know, what is on your must-read list every day? Tom, thank you. Besides listening to NPR, obviously.
Besides listening to NPR, it's always a good question. Right now, as I've got a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old, there's a book about Rapunzel that I'm required to read each morning and night.
I think he's talking about news.
I try to look at a broad variety of things across the country in different regions. I try to look at across the ideological spectrum. I try to vary it each morning, to be honest. But, you know, I pay money for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal. And I think it's worth, sampling a lot of other places besides.
Well, it's been really fun to talk to you, and there's so much more we could have talked about. Lots of people with questions this morning. David, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it.
My great pleasure to join you.
That's NPR's media correspondent, David Folkenflik. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.